All right, well, I want to welcome everybody to our class this morning. Again, as always, it's good to see everyone. We'll continue our study here in Job. We're in chapter 7, so if you want to go ahead and open up to Job chapter 7, we'll be starting around verse 11 or 12, where we ended last week. And just to kind of recap some of the things we talked about last week to get our minds back into it this morning, we took some time to step back and discuss some of the possible intentions behind what these men were saying to each other, and then how that would have been perceived and how those things didn't align. So from the perspective of Job's friends, they see themselves as trying to help Job, but the Job is being too stubborn to listen. Job sees it as they are not listening to him, and they're not taking his own assessment of what's happening seriously. And they're going to keep talking past each other as we go because of this. We spent some time looking at in chapter 7, verses 7 through 11, because it's a little curious to read verses like this in Job, and it's going to continue too, which is why I wanted to try to catch it, you know, now in chapter 7. You're going to see this repeated over and over again, where you have these passages where Job's speaking, where it could be easily interpreted as Job doesn't seem to believe that there's anything that happens to you after you die. He seems to speak as though once you die, that's it. You don't come back. There's no remembrance, and you're basically just done. And we talked about what are some ways we can understand this to mean, because obviously that doesn't harmonize with what the rest of the Bible teaches about a resurrection and an afterlife. So we talked about four possible ways that could be interpreted. Not all of them equal, not all of them, you know, what I would propose is correct. But one way is you could go that route and say, well, Job didn't believe in a resurrection. And you could say, and the author agrees with him and wants us to take that away from it. That's one conclusion some people have reached. But again, like we just said, that doesn't really harmonize very well with what the rest of the scriptures teach. And remember, there is an author here. You know, there is a narrator, and we get the narrator's perspective because we see what happens, you know, in the throne room scene in chapters 1 and 2 when the Satan goes before God and challenges him about Job. So we have the perspective of the narrator, the perspective of the author. So that's one conclusion some may take. Similarly, some could take that Job didn't believe in a resurrection, but the author doesn't necessarily believe with what Job believes and is presenting Job's perspective as not the correct one. So that's another way of looking at it. You know, it could have been that the author expected his primarily Jewish audience to see, well, maybe because Job's an Edomite, maybe he doesn't have a proper understanding of this. And when God holds him as exemplary in his righteousness, maybe that's a commentary, too, on the gracious nature of who God is, that even though Job didn't get this fundamental thing right, he did a lot of other things right that caught God's attention. So that's another way people have read it. It could be that Job is expressing a desire for something that isn't a real option. We've seen him do this before. He has said, I wish I hadn't been born. Is it possible for him to not be born? Obviously not. He can't go back and change that, right? But still, he expresses a desire for it. So you could say this is like that. He's maybe expressing a desire for something that he wants to be true, but isn't really his reality. And then fourth, you could just say, well, you know, Job is just expressing his hopelessness in a very poetic fashion. And, you know, again, as we look through some of these things that we read, it's apparent that some of the richness and depth of the Hebrew language doesn't translate perfectly from the Hebrew language doesn't translate perfectly to English, and we're going to miss some things. Whether that's just by the nature of the translation process, or whether that's the shortcomings of your teacher who doesn't understand all the nuances of what we're going through, there's some stuff that could be in play here that just kind of goes over our head. Okay, so we leave room for that. And again, we just wanted to spend some time on that because that's going to keep coming up. And I don't want that to trip us up when we get into other things that Job says that seem to double down on this idea that Job's like, hey, when we die, that's it. Okay. But however you read verses 7 through 10 in chapter 7, it's obviously meant to set up verse 11. It's part of verses 1 through 10 when Job is kind of explaining how this is the way things are and he's not happy with this. He doesn't think this is how things should be. So in verse 11 in chapter 7, he says, "Therefore I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul." So Job expressing that all these things, whatever, however we understand them, he's setting up saying like, well, this is my reason for why I'm upset and why I'm complaining. Okay, so we get the point of what Job is trying to say here. So then we kind of stopped here. We read verses 12 through the end of the chapter briefly, but we didn't get into them, and I want to spend a little more time with them. So up until verse 11, it seems apparent that Job is still addressing his friends. Remember, in this discourse, he's responding to Eliphaz's criticism of what Job originally said in chapter 3. So this is now Job's response to Eliphaz's response. And then in verse 12, I think you have this turn where Job is not speaking to his friends anymore, but now he is speaking and addressing God directly. So let's work through this verse by verse. In verse 12, he says, "Am I the sea or a sea monster that you set a guard over me?" And this is a rhetorical question he's asking God. He's saying, like, I'm not a threat to you. Right? Because remember, the idea of sea and sea monster, these chaotic, dangerous images that you see repeated throughout the Old Testament, Job's saying, I'm not these things that are a threat. Like, so why are you paying this much attention to me? I think is the point he's telling God, or he's saying to God. And in verse 13, he continues. He says, "When I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions so that I would choose strangling and death rather than my bones." So this word bones, I think the idea is his life. That word kind of means life, if I understand it properly. So he's saying he would choose strangling and death rather than trying to continue to live like this, is the point. So, again, here it's pretty obvious. He's saying there's just no escape from torment. His torment is extending beyond the physical suffering he's going through. He's under significant emotional and mental stress as well. He's being terrified at night by these visions and dreams that he's having. And there's no escape. In verse 16, he says, "I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Leave me alone, for my days are a breath." So there's a couple of ways this could be understood when he says, "I loathe my life." He could just be saying how he feels about his life right now. That's the obvious one. He could be, in a sense, trying to persuade God that he's not trying to gain anything at God's expense. Again, along the lines of like, I'm no threat to you. I'm not trying to get anything out of this. I even hate my own life. Why would I want to do anything to better my life? I hate my life. I loathe it right now. I'm not trying to seek anything from you. So in another way of saying it would be like, what do I have to gain by making myself your enemy? I don't want to be your enemy, I think is a way we could restate that. So then verses 17 through 20, he says, "What is man that you make so much of him and that you set your heart on him? Visit him every morning and test him every moment. How long will you not look away from me nor leave me alone until I swallow my spit? If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? Why have you made me your mark? Why have I become a burden to you?" So again, just continuing this sentiment that he started in verse 12, you know, who am I in comparison to you? Why are you putting all this attention on me? I don't want to challenge you, right? And, you know, again, having the perspective that we have, you know, we can see that, yes, God's attention is on Job, but it's not ultimately for his destruction. And God's going to preserve him through this, but Job doesn't see that yet. God isn't happy are pleased with Job's suffering, like Job believes that he is. In verse 19, this expression is kind of interesting when he says, you know, "How long will you not look away from me nor leave me alone till I swallow my spit?" That expression, till I swallow my spit, I think that's, again, one of those Hebrew things that doesn't really translate well to English. We're kind of like, what is he talking about there? And I think that I was reading a commentary from Albert Barnes, and I thought he had a good way of explaining that. It's a Hebrew expression that's similar to what we would say, you won't even let me catch my breath, is the idea. Like, I can't even come up for air because the beating is just so continual and so rapid. There's no escape from it. I can't even catch my breath. I think is the idea there. And so then in verse 21, just to finish the chapter, and then we'll get into Bildad's turn to speak. Verse 21, he says, "Why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth. You will seek me, but I shall not be." So Job is arguing here that if he sinned, he wants to make that right, but God's not showing him what he did wrong. And if God's not showing him what he did wrong, he can't do anything about it. There's nothing for him to fix because he doesn't know what it was that he did. And when he says here, "For now I shall lie in the earth, you will seek me, but I shall not be," I think he's exaggerating. He's using some hyperbole here of how much focus and attention God is putting on him. He's saying, even if I were to die and not exist, that wouldn't stop you from looking for me to try to find me and punish me more. You're still going to come after me, even if I were to die. That wouldn't be enough for you. So, having kind of read this now, you know, Job, when he spoke in chapter 3, he said some things that bothered his friends, obviously. And then Eliphaz speaks, and we see from Eliphaz's perspective, he's trying to help. He's trying to guide Job back onto the right track, and then Job says this. So how do you think his friends are going to perceive what he has said here? Yeah, Kelly? Yeah. You know, when we get into chapter 8, too, when we start looking at Bildad's response, I think there's some, maybe unintended by Bildad, but some irony about how we're going to benefit from what Job suffered, and how we benefit, how this is obviously done for a reason by God. And the fact that we have Job to study is evidence of that. So there was a reason behind it. It wasn't just Job deciding, or God deciding that it's time for Job to suffer a little bit. I don't have to give him a reason why. Right? It wasn't that. Like, we know that. Obviously, they didn't know that at the time. But obviously, his friends now are going to, they're going to see this as blasphemy. Right? Because Job is basically, the God that he's describing or addressing sounds unjust and sounds like he doesn't have any mercy. He sounds like a merciless being. So we can see it from Job's perspective too, though, right? Because Job is like, well, if God is just, then why won't he tell me what I did wrong so I can fix it? Again, with his limited understanding of what was going on, that's how he was reasoning through it. If God is just, then he would show me what I did wrong. And if God is merciful, he would pardon my sin. I mean, he mentions that too here in chapter 7. Like, if he's merciful, why doesn't he pardon my sin? Yeah, Britt?
Do you think Job is in Can you still have faith and still question the plan?
Yeah, we talked about this quite a bit last week, and it'll keep coming up. I don't think he's in error for being human. I think that where I'm at now is Job is not an individual who we would say is in rebellion against God. He is an individual who is stumbling in his speech because he's being put through it right now. I think that when you get into Job's or God's response to Job at the end of the book, and you see Job's response to God's indictments, how Job owns those in chapter 42, I think Job does see that, yeah, I said some things that were wrong. That's what Job says about what he had said before. So yes, I think that he's speaking things without knowledge. I think that he's stated in several instances already that he's going to give full vent to his spirit. I think that he has even said that the speech of a despairing man is wind. So he's self-aware to some degree that what he's saying isn't really making a lot of sense, but he's just like the donkey is the image he uses in chapter 6, who's going to bray over not having food. Well, you know, braying about not having food is not going to fix the problem, but it's something the donkey can do, right? The donkey can make a loud noise about it. So I think Job kind of puts himself in that position. So I think throughout this, you have Job being self-aware, and I think it's more spawned from bewilderment and the fact that he's just intensely suffering. He probably isn't sleeping. And if I have to look at it from God's perspective, I see him as saying, you know, I'm going to bring Job through this. That's one of my guys down there. I love him. I'm going to bring him through this. We may have to clean some stuff up, but I'm going to bring him through this. That's how I take it. I think that God's indictment exposes more troubling things about the character of Job's friends than it does Job. So we'll get there in a little bit. But again, and I say this every week, right? Every time I read through this, I'm kind of like, maybe I need to move over here a little bit, you know? So I'm still working through some of that. But that's where I am right now. I don't think that Job is, I think it would be reckless to go to what Job says and say, that's how I ought to be when I'm suffering. Yeah. You know, I would say if I were in their shoes, well, he started it. They sat with him for 7 days, saying nothing, and Job spoke first. Now, that doesn't excuse them. And you know, we're going to get into Bildad's first argument here. And there's some stuff in there that I'm like, wow, really? Like, no matter how bothered you are by what Job may have said, like, you're going to go there? So, yeah. Yeah, Job started it. But they tried to finish it. Okay. Chapter 8. Time for Bildad to speak. Verses 1 and 2. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, how long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a great wind? So, I like Bildad because the way he speaks, he makes these connections and ties things together. And he's going to jump off of what Job had said about his own speech. Because Job had talked about how the speech of a despairing man is wind, and he's going to use that and now take that same image here and say, the words of your mouth be a great wind. And knowing that Job had just described his own words this way, I kind of read this as Job is saying, like, you realize you don't have to speak these words, right? Like, no one's making you say these things. You acknowledge yourself that you're speaking nothing but wind at this point. So why do you continue doing that? Like, you know, you've already admitted, like, you're not saying the right things. So I think that's Bildad saying that. So why are you continuing to do this? So then in verse 3, he says, does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert the right? So we see very clearly how they interpreted what Job had said in his last speech, right? They understand Job to be saying God is one who perverts justice, and he is one who perverts those who are right. And they're not going to have anything to do with that. And again, this is like we can see this play out having the benefit of the big picture. Again, we talk about that a lot. And you see in some sense the futility of the argument going back and forth because neither side sees the big picture at this point. Yes, without having the big picture, I would be troubled by someone describing God as someone who perverts justice or who doesn't treat those who are righteous rightly. That would bother all of us, right? So, I mean, I'm not saying Bildad's right in what he's saying, but I think we can relate to it in some ways, especially not having the full picture. We have the benefit of having the big picture. So then in verse 4, he says, "If your children have sinned against them, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression." And this is one of those verses that I was like, wow. Wow. Really? I mean, that's brutal. That's a brutal thing to tell a person who's just lost his children. Can you imagine saying something like that to someone who's lost their children? That's brutal. And do you see how frustrating it is in its passive-aggressive nature, too? How he says, if your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. Well, obviously, they're dead. So what's the implication? Why are you saying if? And I just bring this up, like, have you ever had someone accuse you like this? Or they'd say like, well, I'm not saying you did anything wrong, but if you did, boy, God's going to judge you. I mean, either have enough confidence in the accusation to tell me where I've made a mistake so I can fix it, or don't say anything like that. Like, don't throw this insinuation. Don't try to drop this little seed in my mind of doubt. Well, did I do something wrong? Maybe I need to think about it some more. No, if I did something wrong, tell me I did something wrong. And we may not even agree. Like, if you think I did something wrong, we may not even agree that I did. But let's at least talk about it in a substantive way and not a way that's like, well, let's just cause you to rethink and doubt where you are. Yeah, Kelly? Well, and I'll just ask humbly, if you have a problem with your brother, go to your brother and tell him what the problem is. Don't go to him and say, well, you might have done something wrong, and if you did, oh, man, you better look out. And, I mean, this is a real problem. It's a real problem. I've seen it. Let's not be like that, okay? If we have a problem with our brother, even if it's something we're not sure we ought to say, maybe you just go talk to him and say, hey, I'm struggling with this, okay? Here, I saw you do this, or I heard you did this, and I'm struggling with this. Can we talk about this? Is that what really happened? And work through the issue. Don't work through this whole, well, God may judge you if you did something wrong stuff, okay? That would really frustrate me if I were in Job's position at this point. That would be fighting words. So in verse 5, Bildad continues, if you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. And though your beginning was small, your latter days will be very great. Again, with limited knowledge of what's going on, if I didn't see the bigger picture and we didn't have chapters 1 and 2 and no context as to what was happening to Job, I might not disagree with Bildad here. I mean, would we not tell people, if you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy and be pure and upright, then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation? I don't necessarily agree with that, if I'm speaking axiomatically, right? That's who God has explained how he is and how he operates. But I think we also have to be careful that whenever we're speaking about God or we're speaking for God, that we don't reduce God to a simple logical equation. If A, then B, always and forever, no exceptions. And I think that's the problem here, because this was an exception, however unexpected that exception may have been. This is an exception. Job didn't do anything wrong. Yeah, Sean?
Well, it continues on to insinuate a false foundation. So if this is what happened, it's why your children are dead, and if that's what the reality is, and I like, by the way, how all this started with, they're dead because of his sin. Now they're dead also because of their sin.
Yeah.
And so now it's also, and maybe he's going to plead on behalf of the Lord, he'll restore all things. So it continues to make it worse. Whenever in reality, yes, God can restore it, but there was nothing he was needing to, there was no sin for the basis of this whole thing. Therefore, no needing to repent and be merciful so you can restore this. He's just having to go through it. And now this is adding salt to the wound.
Yeah, it is.
All of us have probably been in that scenario. Like, you know, you apply it to your own situation, you go, well, which, back to your point, be careful with your words and what you say to people, because you can mean well, but you can make a mess out of things.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, we talked too about how this is just it's a tough situation for his friends to be in. Probably in retrospect, they may wish they had just kept their mouth shut. But it is a tough situation to be in. Verses 8 through 10, Bildad continues, "For inquire, please, of bygone ages, and consider what the fathers have searched out. For we are but of yesterday, and know nothing, for our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and utter words out of their understanding?" So Bildad is appealing now to the things that I guess it's sort of this compiled knowledge that has come from generations of people interacting with God, knowing about God, writing about God, theorizing about God. And he's saying, will you go back to all these things that people have written or experienced or spoken, and will you find anybody who is coming to the conclusion that you're coming to? So do you think that it's more reasonable to go with what you're saying, who have been around for, what, a few years? Or should we go with what all these other people have said or written, who have been, you know, this compiled wisdom that, you know, people have built upon? You know, if we didn't have Job's perspective to contrast what Bildad is saying here, then again, there wouldn't be a whole lot to disagree with in principle. You know, we should consider what other people have written and concluded about God. I mean, if we're being humble, there are other people who have come and who have gone who have probably devoted more time to the scriptures than we have, who have put more effort to it, who have been maybe just smarter than we are, who more talented at being able to express their thoughts. And it's reckless and foolish to just throw all that out and be like, no, I can figure it out on my own. Right? I mean, that's in principle, I don't disagree with what Bildad has to say, but we also have Job's perspective, which is contrasting Bildad. And it's interesting that Job is not arguing from having this body of knowledge and these fathers and all the things that they've concluded, but rather he is arguing from his own direct experience of what's going on. He knows he hasn't done anything wrong. And he knows where this suffering's coming from. He's seeing it firsthand. Okay, he's got this firsthand experience. And to him, it's like he knows all that stuff, and he's going to tell them later on, like, you think I don't know this? Like, I know all this stuff. But now he's experiencing something that doesn't really fit with what all those people have experienced before him and all these conclusions people have reached before him. So his firsthand experience is carrying more weight to him. He's not throwing out his firsthand experience to say, well, I must be wrong in some way because what I'm experiencing doesn't match what all these other people are saying. He's like, no, I know what I know, right? So I don't think Job is necessarily discrediting his fathers. And again, like he's going to say he knows all that already. But it's not going to be possible for him to go to their experiences for guidance when their experiences contradict his own. So as Job reckons it, as we would expect friends to do, it would be better for him to just talk to God about this. And I think that's what Job's going to keep asking as we go forward. Like, he just wants to go ask God, what's going on here? Just tell me what's going on. Tell me if I've made a mistake. Tell me what that mistake is. Let me fix it. I don't want to be an enemy to you. And he wants to work this through with God. So another interesting layer here is, I can't help but think about the connection that we have. And I don't know if this is intended or not. I may be pulling this out of context. But where Job is coming from versus where his friends are coming from kind of reminds me of Jesus and the scribes and Pharisees, right? The scribes and the Pharisees had this body of work that they drew their authority from, and how all these rabbis had built conclusions upon other conclusions upon other conclusions. Whereas Jesus' authority, he claims, is from his direct relationship with his Father, right? He's experienced the Father and he knows the Father, and that's why he has his authority. So there's a little bit of parallel here. I don't think that puts Job in the position of a Jesus-like character, but we understand that connection or conflict has happened in the New Testament. Sorry, there's a fly buzzing around my head. It's highly distracting. We soldier on. Yes? And that's why I keep saying, like, can we at least appreciate the difficult position that Job's friends are in? Because if someone were speaking to me now, claiming this firsthand experience of how God's doing this thing for them, I wouldn't accept that, right? I mean, we can relate to that. At least I can. I can relate to that. I mean, I shouldn't speak for everybody, but I can relate to that. It's a difficult situation to be in. So we have to be careful with all that. Anyway, difficult situation to be in, because in this case there is an exception, and what Job is experiencing is not the status quo that his friends are used to. So for the rest of the chapter now, I want to just quickly compare kind of Eliphaz and Bildad's arguments. If you'll remember back in Eliphaz's response, one of the main themes you see in his response was he contrasts man and God by focusing on, like, the moral distance between them. Like, God is so much better than man, and who is man in comparison to God? Bildad's going to do pretty much the same thing, but instead of focusing on that moral distance, he's going to talk about God's ability to endure and man's inability to endure, and how man depends on God. And that distance is there too, right? Whereas in Eliphaz's case, it's how much better God is than man. In Bildad's case, it's how much more enduring God is than man. So if you want to quickly remember, like, what's the main point? How do I remember what Eliphaz said or Bildad said? Eliphaz is, man needs God because only God is good. Bildad would be, man needs God because only God sustains. Okay, that's going to be kind of the point he's going to make here. So verses 11 and 12, Bildad continues, can papyrus grow where there is no marsh? Can reeds flourish where there is no water? While yet in flower and not cut down, they wither before any other plant. So, you know, the idea there being if a plant or a flower were to appear where there's no water for it to grow, then as lovely as it might seem for a very short period of time, it's going to die quickly. And then in verse 13, Bildad says, such are the paths of all who forget God. The hope of the godless shall perish. So the idea here, when he says those who forget God, it's not just the idea of putting God out of mind, but it's the idea of neglecting to realize our dependence on God. We don't realize we need God like a plant that might try to take root in very shallow water doesn't realize the importance and its dependence on water. So we are if we try to go our own way and not realize our dependence on God. Verses 14 and 15. His confidence is severed and his trust is a spider's web. He leans against his house, but it does not stand. He lays hold of it, but it does not endure. So the idea here is the foolish man who's placed his hope in something other than God, maybe himself. It's like a person who's trying to make a house out of a spider's web. That's going to fall apart pretty quickly when you try to go inside of it and live there, right? It's not going to endure, and how much less is it going to endure the elements like the winds and the rains? So that would be Bildad's comparison to the foolish person not trusting in God. In verse 16, he says, "He is a lush plant before the sun, and his shoots spread over his garden. His roots entwine the stone heap. He looks upon a house of stones. He is destroyed from his place. Then it will deny him, saying, 'I have never seen you.' Behold, this is the joy of his way, and out of the soil others will spring." So now we have this imagery of this soil and this plant trying to take root. And it's very much like the parable of the sower, right? You've got this, he's talking about this rocky ground. So in verse 16, you know, this plant takes off kind of in this rocky soil, like it grows quickly. But then in verse 17, his roots entwine the stone heap. The roots are trying to get down in there, and all it's finding is rock. And he looks upon a house of stones, meaning like this is where he's made his home, right? Now he's got to deal with these rocks that are down here. And then in verse 18, if he is destroyed from his place, then it will deny him, saying, "I have never seen you." And I read this as the ground speaking to the plant when it ultimately dies. The ground here is being portrayed as merciless in the sense that it's not providing any nutrients for the plants. And then it says, and you know what? It's your own fault for trying to grow here. So according to Bildad, the plant is suffering for its foolish choice of where it tried to make its home. And likewise, according to Bildad, Job, this is the implication, Job is suffering for his foolish choice of what he's done to provoke God, whatever that may be. From Bildad's perspective. And then in verse 19, he said, "Behold, this is the joy of his way, and out of the soil others will spring." So the idea here is that now that this plant has died, it's left behind itself in the form of soil, and now other plants are going to hit that soil, and they're going to start growing in that same space. And it's ironic and it's a little tragic that the plant in its death is making the ground more fertile than it was before it died. But yet other plants now who are going to try to come and grow where that plant was, they're going to hit those same rocks. Like the ground is going to look even more appealing to them, but when they try to take root, those rocks are still there. And the same fate is going to befall them as well. So I think the point is, Bildad saying, look, Job, what you're saying, it's not only bad for you, it's bad for anyone who listens to you. Anyone else who might try to follow in the same path that you're going. And I think that's the way of Bildad saying, I'm not buying any of this. I'm not going to set myself up like you. I'm not going to follow that path because I see where it goes. Even though you try to make it look more alluring, like a dead plant's going to have more soil that other plants might want to try to grow in, I'm not going to go there because I know what's underneath your argument. It's nothing but rocks and ultimately death, right? And then another little bit of irony here. If we stick with Bildad's analogy, and again, knowing the bigger picture like we do, that proverbial soil that we're talking about here, that Job has planted his roots in, it's not rocky at all. Job has planted his roots in God. And we see that, and God sees that. It's not rocky soil. There's something else going on. And yes, Job is being destroyed right now. He's being broken down. But like Bildad says, others are going to benefit from this. They're going to benefit from what Job's going through. And I think that that's kind of ironically talking about anyone who would come to the book of Job and read it. We have the book of Job, and we're benefiting from the things that Job went through, through his suffering. I mean, God preserved this for a reason, for us to study it and think about it and work through it and apply it for when we're going through difficult times. Right? So in a way, we're benefiting like those other plants would benefit from the death of that first plant. We're benefiting too, but the ground is good. It's not rocky like Bildad claims that it is. So then in verse 20, he says, "Behold, God will not reject a blameless man, nor take the hand of evildoers." True. That's true. But we know that's not the case with Job. What Job is going through right now has nothing to do with any of that. It's just this is an exception, right? And then in verse 21, Bildad says, "Yet he will fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting." So like any good preacher, Bildad's bringing his conclusion back around to where he began, right? He starts his argument talking about the emptiness of Job's mouth and this wind that's coming out of it. And he brings it back around. "Your mouth will be filled with laughter and your lips with shouting." So instead of these empty words and cursings and these negative things you're hearing, if you'll just turn to God, why wouldn't you rather have laughing coming out of your mouth and shouts of joy and good things? So then in verse 22, Bildad says, "Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more." Now, obviously, Bildad would not knowingly bring a curse upon himself or his friends when he talks about those who hate him, how they'll be clothed with shame and the tent of the wicked will be no more. So I read this as Bildad kind of subtly reminding Job, we don't hate you because I'm not going to curse myself, right? But those who hate you will have this curse, but obviously I wouldn't curse myself. So it's like I'm saying, I'm not speaking this from the perspective of hate. I'm saying this because I love you and I care about you. That's how I interpret this. So then in chapter 9, where we'll plan to pick up next week, we're going to get into Job's response now to Bildad. And actually, Job goes back and he addresses Eliphaz some more in chapter 9 as well. He specifically addresses some of the things that Eliphaz spoke. Yes, Britt?
I think it'd be interesting. Because it all lines up. Even a lot of the things he says actually do happen. He is blessed later. He is found blameless. All of this happens to Job. He doesn't know it's going to happen. But this is the same line of questioning and the same line of logic that was used by the prophets who presented this information to the corrupt kings. And so the fact that he's doing it to Job, he looks just nuts. But if he was doing this to one of the corrupt kings, we'd always say, yeah.
That's exactly my point. That's exactly my point. We can appreciate at a minimum what Bildad is saying based on what he knows. And I don't see it being all that different than some of the things I might think, maybe even say. I don't think I'd go after the man's kids. But you know, there's a lot of stuff in here that obviously aligns with what scriptures teach. So again, you know, what are we to take away when we're going through this? First thing, it's okay to accept the fact that this isn't easy. There isn't an immediate and obvious application sometimes to some of the things we're reading. And I think that my understanding of difficult books of the Bible, and I take this about Revelation as well, rather than trying to fit everything in Revelation into some historical context, one context or another. I take Revelation as something that has always been mysterious, will always be mysterious, and I don't expect that anybody's going to come up with a perfect way of understanding it that's going to get everybody else to agree with what it says. some irrefutable argument. So what are we to do in that case? Well, I think maybe the reason we have these difficult Bibles is because the value is in the process of working through it. Perhaps not in, the value may not be in drawing a perfect understanding of it, but the process of getting there. We're thinking about things of God, and we're looking at things from other perspectives, and we're considering the context behind arguments and how some arguments work in some contexts and they don't work in other contexts. And all this, I think, adds to our spiritual character. I think it adds to our wisdom. So I see a lot of value in working through it, even though I can't just tell you, here's what it means, you know. And again, I keep moving around a little bit on some of it as I go through it. So we're about out of time. Job chapter 9, I just want to say before we get into it, for probably like the last maybe 10 years of my life, Job chapter 9 has been one of those chapters that just really stands out to me. It's been really impactful to me when I think about the nature of God and the nature of me in comparison to God. There's some profound things in it, and they become even more profound when you contextualize them as coming from a man who's just blowing wind. You know, what am I to do with that, right? But it's really just, it's meant a lot to me, you know, as I've tried to grow in my understanding of God. So I'm really looking forward to digging in. There's quite a bit to work through there, but the plan is next week we'll continue in chapter 9. Thank you so much for your good comments and questions.